Well, could you first tell me, Mr. Priestley, where and when you were born?
I was born in High Wycombe, Buckinghamshire, in February 1915.
Which date in February? Which day in February?
22nd of February.
And who were your parents?
My parents were Hugh Priestley, who married a Miss Hall, Elizabeth Hall. So I was the son of Hugh Priestley and Elizabeth Hall.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was in Lang and Cruickshank before the 1418 War. When he came back from the war, he found that other people had been promoted over his head and was not very happy with Lang and Cruickshank. And he went then to Wed Jefferson, which eventually I joined, because a senior partner, Jack Russell, knew him and asked him to join them. He then served there for a number of years and then was picked out by the government broker, who was then Eddie Gosling of Mullins, and he went to Mullins with a view to becoming government broker when Eddie Gosling retired, but unfortunately he died in 1946, so he never became government broker.
Had any of your grandparents been in the city?
No.
Had you known any of your grandparents?
Yes, I knew both of them. Dr. Priestley was an ordinary doctor, and his great grandfather, of course, was a great scientist who discovered oxygen. On my mother's side, he was a parson who ran a school at Northall called Northall School, and he was a parson.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes. I've got an elder brother who's still alive, who's 4 years older than me, who's in Mullins. And I had a younger brother who died about 5 years after the war.
And your father was pursuing a career in the city. Was the stock exchange, the stock market, something that he talked about at home? Were you, as a young boy, able to form much of an impression about what your father did?
No, I had really no impression. In fact, the only impression I can really remember is I actually thought that he dealt in stockings. And really, until I sort of went into the city, no, I had very little idea of what he did.
Mm-hmm. Where did your parents send you to school?
I went to school at Horace Hill, followed by Winchester College. And then, in fact, my father died and I couldn't go to Bastia because there wasn't enough money. So I went to America for a year to a school called Western Reserve Academy before going into the city.
What was your reason for going to America?
Because I was going to go to the varsity. You didn't have to pass an exam, I wouldn't get in today. But then I wanted to do something rather than go straight into the city, so I actually got a scholarship because you didn't have to pass an exam. I went up before five headmasters, I think it was, in London, and they accepted me, just asked me a few questions, and I had a very happy year in America as a result.
Would you say your parents had had a great influence on you?
Oh yes, definitely. My father particularly, I think he was very keen on games, and so was I. He never went abroad. He was much loved and admired by everybody. He was, in fact, very tall. He was 6 foot six. And I think he was the first person in the Gilt Edge Market that they closed the market for an hour or two when he died. I believe that to be so.
What was the attitude to money in the family?
To money?
Yes.
In the early days, we were definitely badly off, I think, and I don't think money was really talked about very much. I would say after that we were comfortable, and of course, later on when he went to Mullins and things, we were comparatively well off. But in the early days, I think it was a struggle for my parents to send us to private and public schools. Mm. We certainly had a car much later than most people. Mm. And our holidays used to be in a sort of bus going down to the sea, that sort of thing. We were not brought up in great luxury.
At Winchester, did any of the masters have a particular influence on you?
Well, I was a very keen games player, and I think the late Harry Otham, who was a great cricketer, had a big influence on me. And also, because I was very stupid, I used to have private tuition with an also famous England cricketer called Rockley Wilson. And between the two of them, yes, they had a big influence on me, I think.
What was the feeling about the city or the stock market in the school? What would the boys have thought about someone going into the stock exchange for a career?
I don't think the boys ever really discussed that very much. Certainly the city hadn't got a very high name. I think most people thought the people who went there were rather like me, who had very little brain but hoped to make some money. And I think that was really the sort of feeling about the stock exchange in those days, which it certainly was in my father's day.
So you went to Westonbury in the United States,
yeah,
and then returned to England.
That's right.
What happened to you then?
Well, my mother was looking for a job for me, and we had a great friend in the senior partner of Robert Nivison called Lord Glendine. And my mother tried to ask him whether he would take me, and he said no, because he didn't like mixing friendship with business. And then the senior partner was still Jack Russell, then, who knew my father very well, offered to take me on trial, and so I went into Wedgerson just simply like that. The old boy net, I suppose, is the answer. Mm-hmm. On £80 a year.
And very roughly, when was that? Was that the...
About 1933.
Do you have any early memories of the firm or the...
Indeed I do,
partners?
Yes. There were three of us joined practice. I actually joined first, but 6 months later, Dick Wilkins, who's quite a famous name, and Dick Russell joined. And we all three were in the office, as far as I remember, just writing in bond numbers in a book. But what I particularly remember is when payday came once a month, we received one £5 note, £1 note, and a little bit of change. Whereas the partner's money every week, which was handled by the same clerk who used to smoke a cigarette with the ash falling off the top of it. I remember George Wilkins, Dick Wilkins' father, I think he drew £50 a week to pay the wages, and I thought how rich he must be. I can't believe that anybody would ever be like that again. And of course all the clerks were drawing several fivers. But I managed very well on the £80 a year, and £200 my mother could allow me, and on that I could take a girl to the Savoy once a week and live very happily at home.
What were the offices like? Was it a fairly big firm?
No, it was a small firm. I would have said about six or seven partners and about 40 staff, something of that size. And I do remember a little later on, we didn't change much in size for some years, being horrified and looking at the expenses, which I think were between 40 and 50,000 a year.
What were the offices like physically? Were they small or...?
The offices were just adequate, yes. There was nothing pretentious about them. There was never any drink or any entertainment of any sort. And the partners and dealers had a room. We had about two rooms, I suppose, but in those days, you see, we were gilt edge only. So there was only a colonial department, a corporation department, a gilt edge department. So we had three rooms, I think, for the partners, and about 45 for staff. We just worked. The gilt edge market didn't open until 10, so we got there about 9:30. The stock exchange closed at 3 or 5:30, and then we worked in the office probably till about 5. It was quite a comfortable life in those days.
Did you have any ambitions for your life at this stage? Did you think in terms of the future?
We're now rather switching from there till after the war, because I was only there for a short time before the war. After the war, yes, I was married and had children. I wanted to make enough money to send my children to school, because I had no inherited wealth of any amount. My only ambition, really, I think, was to get on and make enough money to educate my children and everybody else, really.
Let's revert to the pre-war period. What were the first jobs that the firm had you doing?
The first job, as I say, was working on the ledgers in the office. The next job was when I was a blue button. And a blue button in those days, you stood at the end of a bench facing the partners who were around a sort of pillar about 15 yards away. And they used to hold up their hand like that. And Dick Wilkins and Dick Russell and I used to try and beat each other to do it, to raise what in Winchester they used to call an oily quill, in other words, to be thought well of if you got there first. And I was rather more aesthetic than the other two and used to get terrible stick, because I think I very often got there first. But our principal thing was to go and give messages to people. And I remember one young man who should be nameless, who didn't stay very long, who was sent for by senior partner Jack Russell, and said, what was the price of war loan? And he said, I don't know what the price of that was, but it was so-and-so won the St. Ledger. But he went next day.
Do you have any other particular early memories of the Stock Exchange at that time? Can you remember?
I remember being very fearful of the senior partners, particularly Jack Russell, who was a frightening character, always wore a bowler hat, and he came back from lunch and put his hat on the rack above him. And there was definitely a hush of silence whenever he came in. Yes, he was there were some commanding figures. I suppose one feels that more when one was young, and probably those who came after me felt it too, but he was certainly a very commanding figure.
Was Wed a family firm?
Yes, it was, really. I don't think Wed was ever very much. I think he probably had some money, but the Jefferson family were the real ones, and the Russells and the Wilkinses were all, I think, connected to the Jefferson side of the family. It was very much a family firm.
And how did Wed compare with other gilt jobbers at this time? Was it?
When I first joined, I think Francis and Praed were definitely number one. I would have said we were probably number two, but not much difference between us and Aykroyd and Smithers, as they were then. Francis and Praed were definitely number one, I think.
Do you have any early recollections of being in the Stock Exchange itself? Was it a busy place? Was it a crowded place?
Yes, it was like a big club, really, I think. It wasn't excessively noisy or anything. But what impressed me was the very little writing that went on. I mean, everything was done by word of mouth, and you just had a little book. And maybe you occasionally had to stand by a partner and write down that he'd bought something or sold something. My experience was only the Gilt Edge market. And I think it struck me, and a word of my bond very much was so, because there used to be queries sometimes. Somebody would forget to book something, or somebody said they'd done something, but it was always settled amicably. And there was an amazing amount of trust, I think.
Were you a blue button for a long time?
I was a blue button I joined in 1933. I suppose I must have been more than a year in the office. I was a dealer. I was a blue button, therefore, for about 3 years, and I was a dealer for about 6 months or a year before the war, which broke out in 1939. So I was a dealer I was then on £400 a year when war broke out in 1939.
Can you describe what was involved in being a dealer?
Yes. There were usually three dealers on each book. There were three dealers, mostly partners, on the big government book. And then there was a short government book where there were probably another three dealers. The next most important one, which I joined, was the colonial book, which was quite big in those days because it had Canada and Africa and India and number of things which all disappeared. And then the smallest and last, no, there were two more actually. There was one, the corporation book for the local corporation stocks. And then there was a, what I call an odds and sods book, which I think did various sort of things like stock exchange shares, and I can't remember exactly what they did. So I suppose in all there were about 16 or 17 people dealing, something of that order.
How did you actually learn your jobbing skills? Did you feel...
I think jobbing skills are a funny thing. I think really you've got to have a flair for it. Funnily enough, the clever people, people with big brains, were not, as a rule, good jobbers, because they thought too far ahead or were worrying about something that was going to happen. I think it's something you had a flair for. You suddenly got a feeling. There was an atmosphere in the stock exchange which must be missing nowadays, and you could somehow feel suddenly that the market wasn't any good or that it was going to go better. And I think you had to be, I don't know whether born with that, or perhaps you had to be have a bookish mentality. But it was largely your skill, I think, was on flair. That's the only thing I can think of. I mean, you could read all the things in the market. Obviously, sometimes it was obvious because all the press said the market was going up. But when you were actually in the market, I think it was, you suddenly got a feeling, not always right, of course, but you suddenly got a feeling as a, it was going down or up, and you had to be more right more often than you were wrong. As simple as that.
Can you remember your feelings when you became a dealer? Did you find it initially something that was a bit frightening?
Yes, I was under a very difficult man called John Longett Higgins, who's long since died. And he was very unpopular in the firm, but I think I learnt more from him than anybody else. Because I remember coming back from lunch one day, or I think it was just before he went to lunch, he bought a whole line of New Zealand stock. And there was a great rumour at that time that the New Zealand government was going to go broke. And he said to me before lunch, I've just bought 100,000 or something like that of this New Zealand stock, that's not for sale. And shortly after he'd gone, somebody came up and asked me a price, which I've called Anstey of Wigram. And I made a ridiculously high price, thinking, you know, that in no way would he buy anything, and he bought stock from me. So I was in a panic, didn't know what to do. Shortly after, he came back again. Now, so I made him a very much higher price, and he bought it again. When this Longett Higgins came back from lunch, I said, well, you know, I have actually sold a few New Zealand stock at a very good price. And he said to me, I told you not to sell that stock. Go and buy them back. So I went round the market, which you have to do, to my rivals and all that sort of thing, bidding up the price, and of course I couldn't buy any. But by doing that, he put the price of his own stock, the remaining of it, up about another 3 points, and that was a very good lesson to learn.
Did you have any particular disasters as a young dealer?
I don't think so, because as a young dealer you always referred to the senior, but you didn't really have a responsibility of running the book. You were there really just to make prices and were probably told roughly what to make, and it was a limited the amount until you got to running the book itself. Or number two, after all, before the war I was the dog's body. No, I don't think in those days you had a great worry on that score.
Did the colonial market have its own characteristics that were slightly different to the main gilt?
Yes, yes, I think it was. It was very much a specialised market. And of course, the Crown agents were great performers in the market in those days, and they used to buy up their own stock. And there used to be ways of making money out of the Crown agents, looking back on it. They would always buy the stock, provided there was a mark on the board more or less the price that you were asking for it. So I'm afraid what we used to do, if you bought a nice line of stock, which wasn't all that common, you would then go around the little dealers and find if they got a little bit of stock on their book, and you'd buy that at a high price and stick a mark in, and then you could make a nice profit out of the Crown agents when they came in to buy the stock because they saw a mark and it was all right. That's really all I remember.
Did you see much of the brokers who acted on behalf of the various?
Yes, all the time. Scrimgeour, in fact, was the dealer for the Crown agents in those days.
Do you remember whether the political atmosphere of the period, thinking about the late 1930s, whether that had a big influence on the market? You think of the period as being one of crises.
No, I don't think so, except immediately before an election or something of that sort. No, I don't think it did. My memory is always really is we did slightly better under a socialist government than we did under a conservative government overall, as far as I remember.
Was the stock exchange in the 1930s a very different institution to what it later became? Was it a very formal place? Were there very rigid dress standards?
Yes, obviously, like everything else in the country, it was more formal with bowler hats and ties and, you know, pinstripe suits and everything. And gradually, after the war, it gave way fairly quickly, I think, to more or less formal. It didn't change a great deal, except slight dress. In fact, we had one chap who was very good, who had very long hair, who we wanted to promote and bring downstairs and offered him the promotion, but he refused to cut his hair.
Are there any particular characters who stand out in the memory from your younger days on the stock exchange?
Particularly this John Longard Higgins, and of course Dick Wilkins's father, George Wilkins. He was an absolute charmer, delightful person. Did not get on very well with John Longard Higgins, who was much cleverer, and he was probably the brains behind. And Jack Russell, who I've already mentioned. Yes, they were all three in different ways. Pretty powerful characters.
Did you form much impression about the number of jobbers around you generally? Were there a lot of firms more or less your size? Were there smaller firms?
There were always in my day, before the war, only three that really counted were Ackroyd and Smithers and Francis McRae and ourselves.
What distinguished those firms from the other firms?
I think Francis Braid inherited from somebody whose name I've forgotten, who was very famous in his day. I think he'd gone by the time I got there, and I think they inherited the thing, which they gradually lost. And then, of course, the Ackroyd and Smithers were very much the Smithers family, and they were rather. I think Langley Smithers, senior partner, was clever, but one or two, they were all charming, but. I don't think they had great talent in those days. I think nor did we, really. I think we were rather going on the reputation of Jefferson and all those people. I think they all had money, those partners, and I think it's much more difficult when you've got money to go ahead and do it better, rather than when you're hungry. And I think when all the old boys go, and various people like ourselves were very hungry, we had much more ambition than they did. They just wanted the quiet life. They had their money and they had their country houses. And I think, you know, it was rather a status quo immediately after the war. And it wasn't until they went and you got rather ambitious younger people that came on that the character of the thing changed a bit.
So, were they very competitive among themselves, or were they quite happy to keep things ticking over and make an adequate living?
It's difficult to say, because really I'm talking about a period really before I was a dealer. No, I think they weren't nearly as competitive as later on. I don't think they ever asked anybody out to the theatre or tried to. They were just very pleasant to each other, and the government broker came around and they chatted to everybody. I don't think there was the competition that there was later on. There wasn't a business for a start. I mean, the government debt in those days, I wouldn't know now what it was, but it increased enormously after the war, as you well know.
Have you got any recollection about how large the bargains were that you were doing?
When I was started dealing in a colonial book, 25,000 was quite big. And then I think when I, after when I took over, at one time 50,000 was quite big, and so then of course it escalated after that. In the government book, I didn't go on the government book till sometime after the war. And then of course it, I think when I first went on, it was probably 100,000 was quite big, and then it went on to not as big as it is now, but you know, 5 million was quite big.
What was the attitude to the profession of being a jobber as a young man? Do you have any recollections about that? Was it simply one among many professions in the city, or were the brokers regarded as being a cut above the jobbers?
Oh, I think certainly. I would have said jobbers were considered the lowest of the low.
Why was that?
Well, because I think rather the same as perhaps bookmakers are by some people are looked down on. I mean, that's all a jobber was. He was just a bookie. Having said that, there were many friends amongst the brokers and things, but certainly I think I was inclined to say, if somebody asked me what I did something in the city rather than saying I was a jobber, partly because nobody knew what a jobber was, and partly also because it was, you know, it was considered a pretty low form of life, I think.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you became an authorised dealer very shortly before the outbreak of war. Can you just very briefly, to fill in those years, describe what happened to you? Very briefly. When did you join the forces? Was it before 39?
Funnily enough, this Longett Higgins I've talked about was very keen for us to join something. So Dick Wilkins and I joined the Hertfordshire Regiment, Territorials, which was then two nights a week or whatever it was. And then, when, of course, war broke out, we went there full time. But I wasn't very happy there for reasons I won't go into. So I wrote to my brother, who was a regular Coldstream, and asked him whether he could get me into the Coldstream. So after about me, I left Dick Wilkins and went to the Coldstream, and then they became armoured, and I spent 2 years, I suppose, learning all about tanks, and went across on D-Day plus 40 in 1944, and it was there that I first received the letter just before we went on the big attack at Caen, asking me whether I'd like to become a partner, either 0.5% or 1%, I can't remember, of the profits. It seemed very funny just about going to a big attack, but I thought I was very unlikely to survive.
Have you got any idea why they decided to ask you to become a partner at that rather odd time, entirely apart from the fact that you're about to go into battle? It was 1944, the war was still on.
I have absolutely no idea, and I'm just thinking back on it today as I was when I actually received it. I mean, my reaction was not sort of chill, just roaring with laughter. Couldn't believe it was possible. I suppose they were leading an ordinary sort of life in England. I suppose it didn't sort of occur to them, you know. On leave, I think I'd been back to see the farm. But no, I was absolutely amazed. Mm.
What had happened to the firm when war broke out?
Well, I think almost all people of an age then went, and it was run by a skeleton staff, plus one or two, I think, that weren't fit or something of that sort. And it went on much the same, but there was excess profits tax, which I can't remember what it was worked out at, but I think it was about 120,000 or something for Jefferson. When you made that amount, you you gave all the rest to government. So it ticked over and they were all right, I think. They went on paying me my 400 a year, I think, as I don't remember.
So you more or less assumed that when the war was over, you would be returning back to the city and back to
the job. I don't think it ever occurred to me that I would do anything else. No.
When did you leave the services?
I left I ended up at Bonn, in where the government houses are now, in a rehabilitation scheme with a chap called John Hazelwood. We ran a sort of rehabilitation school, and I suppose I must have come out about 1945 sometime, went back to the city.
Were you married by this stage?
Yes. I married on 9/9/39, 5 days after the war broke out. And I was so important as second lieutenant priestley in the Hertfordshire Regiment, and I wasn't allowed more than 5 miles from my headquarters at St Albans, so we spent our honeymoon on Ashley's golf course.
How had you met your wife?
I knew her before the war. I met her actually at a dance on the night the Crystal Palace was burnt down, sure by chance.
Can you remember what it was like